But what was electricity good for? Today, electricity drives our machines, lights our halls, monitors our studies of man. Dream telepathy dealing with the individual's efforts to make contact with distant reality and with the social nature of man's unconscious powers is likely to be among the sparks which will be made into a science within the next century. We cannot afford to ignore such sparks. Whether telepathy or psi, if real, will truly advance the case for survival after death was called into question by the parapsychologist Charles O. Norton. He said psi was a double-edged sword. He conceded that a power of the mind capable of acting outside our five senses raised the possibility of an aspect of mind capable of surviving physical death. On the other hand, he said such a power of psi could itself explain the phenomena people regarded as evidence for survival. In other words, people are not in touch with the dead, they are simply obtaining information from elsewhere by telepathy. That's an argument we can judge only after looking at the direct evidence for life after death. Part 2 Visions and Voices. See next chapter. Chapter 6 Back from the Dead. And when he had thus spoken, Christ cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. The Bible, John 11, 43-44. For many people the story of Lazarus has always been a fairy tale. But if Lazarus was raised from the dead today, he would probably be regarded as neither a fairy tale nor a miracle, just another near-death experience. There are more Lazaruses about today than in biblical times. Thousands each year are raised from the dead by the wonders of scientific medicine. The startling aspect is that a great many of them testify that, when seemingly dead, they experienced an existence in another dimension. Recent Gallup surveys have shown that millions of people worldwide have had these near-death experiences. Until a few years ago, scientific orthodoxy treated such claims with derision. Some medical men who published studies of these cases were ostracized and some were penalized by the withdrawal of grants for research. Nowadays, near-death experiences are so overwhelmingly widespread that they have forced their way into the pages of the scientific journals. The explanation put forward in most cases is that these are hallucinations in a dying brain, a defense mechanism against the trauma of death. But many serious observers have studied the evidence and find this verdict hard to accept. They sense a genuine mystery, even if many are reluctant to accept near-death experiences at their face value. Signs of a true dimension beyond death, which some people have entered and returned from. A typical near-death experience might be a person who appears to die from a heart attack, but is revived in hospital. The patient claims to have been out of body, and, while apparently deeply unconscious, to have watched nurses and doctors at work. He or she had traveled down a black tunnel towards a brilliant light and in an atmosphere of love and harmony, met someone, perhaps a religious figure like Jesus Christ or Krishna, who told them to go back. In some cases, the patient was shown a complete review of his past life. Similar deathbed visions, dreams of angels and glimpses of an afterlife, have been reported for many centuries. Were they fantasies modeled on each culture's archetypal ideas about life after death, or could it be the other way around? Today, some observers believe traditional religious texts describing the next world might be based upon ancient near-death experiences. Among antique writings, the Egyptian Book of the Dead and the Tibetan Book of the Dead both describe realms of existence beyond death, which more or less conform with modern near-death experiences. The Tibetan Book of the Dead is an instruction manual to be whispered in the ear of the deceased. The texts guide him through his various encounters in the spirit world, and perhaps enable him to escape the cycle of rebirth and move to a higher plane of existence. Like someone going through a modern near-death experience, he meets a series of beings surrounded by brilliant light. The Egyptian Book of the Dead also bears comparison to a near-death experience. The deceased enters the afterlife on a boat down a black tunnel heading towards a bright light. Ancient Egyptians induced near-death experiences to attain wisdom. Followers of the cult of Osiris, the god Pharaoh, were locked into coffins and suffocated. They were then revived at the brink of death, undergoing this ordeal in order to experience the black tunnel and see the bright light, an archetypal near-death experience. Not everyone who has a near-death experience has a good trip, although most find it a life-enhancing experience. Lazarus, whom Christ raised from the dead, was glad to be called back after a very unhappy time in the next world. He was in the realm the ancients called purgatory, where the souls of dead sinners were cleansed. Lazarus, after his miraculous revival, not surprisingly became a devout follower of Christ, and was either expelled from the Holy Land for his beliefs or found it expedient to leave about the time of the crucifixion. He took ship to the island of Cyprus, and spent the rest of his days in the town of Larnaca, where the church of St. Lazarus is named after him. The legend he left behind is of a man who never smiled. What he had seen and experienced in his short stay in the next world sobered him for life. Nowadays, few people admit to near-death experiences that give them a foretaste of hell. Perhaps it's something they want to keep to themselves. The consensus is that most near-death experiences are joyous experiences. Since Raymond Moody's book Life After Life in 1975, many thousands of cases have been reported and analyzed by study groups around the world, and there is an International Association for Near-Death Studies. Fascinating research into the near-death experiences of children has been carried out in Seattle, USA by pediatrician Dr. Melvin Morse, author of Closer to the Light – Learning from the Near-Death Experiences of Children. I met Dr. Morse one Sunday morning in the busy Children's Hospital in Seattle where he was examining babies and reassuring anxious mothers. He told me about his first near-death experience case in 1982, a 7-year-old girl who nearly drowned in a local swimming pool. She was as close to death as you could get without dying, and was in a deep coma for 3 days. She had no pulse or respiration for 19 minutes. Ordinarily, brain damage sets in after just 6 minutes without oxygen, but somehow, the child made a full recovery. Dr. Morse, with no knowledge of near-death experiences, asked her what she remembered about the incident in the swimming pool. He wanted to find out whether she had hit her head, or possibly had a seizure. To his surprise, she replied, "Do you mean when I met the Heavenly Father?" He was startled, and the girl became embarrassed and refused to talk further. 3 weeks later, at a follow-up interview, Dr. Morse learned her story. She could actually see me while I was resuscitating her. What was even more extraordinary, she could give me all sorts of accurate details about what we had done to her. For example, she accurately reported we had put a tube in her nose. She said, "First you worked on me in a big room and then you took me to a little room, where you put me into a big machine." That was, of course, a small child's description of what we had done medically. She had never seen me before while conscious and yet she claimed to recognize me and told her mother, "That's the one with the beard who was working on me." The child told Dr. Morse that in her near-death experience the world became dark and she grew frightened. Then a woman came towards her named Elizabeth, who had golden hair, and the world became light. Elizabeth told the child she was there to help, and took the girl to a place she perceived as heaven, where she met lots of other children and adults. Dr. Morse continued the tale, some had just died and others were waiting to be reborn. The girl was allowed to see what her family was doing and she met someone she thought was Jesus. He asked if she wanted to stay with him and the child replied that she did. But she was told it was her responsibility to help her mother and she was returned to her body. After hearing this remarkable story, I became fascinated by these experiences. At the very least, comatose patients seemed to have extraordinary abilities which we have never properly understood. I had thought they were unconscious, when it was obvious from her description of her resuscitation that she was aware during the entire process. I determined to study these experiences further. Over the next 8 years, Dr. Morse questioned hundreds of children who survived cardiac arrest. Comatose patients, eyes closed, could accurately describe their treatment and even knew what the nurses were saying at their bedsides. Many described leaving the physical body, seeing their own body below them with people attempting to revive them, and entering a world of darkness before seeing a brilliant light. Dr. Morse set up a research team, the Seattle Study, which included neurologists and psychiatrists. One question they asked was wherein the brain could near-death experiences be generated. They found that the temporal lobe was an area genetically coded for having near-death experiences. Two members of the team took part in experiments to stimulate the brain electrically. When this happened, the patients said, "Oh my God, I have left my body." We then had to speculate why would we have such a place in our brains? What possible function could it serve? The only answer that we had come up with is that this is an area of the brain which allows the sense of self or soul. It allows the soul at least to think it's leaving the body. There's a limit to how far science can go, and I don't feel we will ever be able to prove the existence of a soul. It's not going to be weighed or measured in a laboratory. But if you don't believe in a soul, you're stuck with trying to explain why we have an area of our brain which allows us to think we leave our body at the point of death. Some doctors feel this could become a natural defense mechanism, to ease a person through the dying process. That's not entirely satisfactory, because it's hard to think what evolutionary pressure could generate this, since the person is dying anyway and there would be no survival advantage to think they were leaving their body at the point of death. Dr. Morse said science can explain all the aspects of a near-death experience, except for the perception of light at the end of the tunnel. The initial idea of a tunnel can be explained by the cut-off of blood to the occipital lobes at the back of the brain, causing tunnel vision. There was also the area of the brain, which could allow patients to imagine they were leaving their body, possibly as a natural defense mechanism against a life-threatening situation. And it would make sense for a patient to enter a world of darkness when his brain was dying and sensory input had shut down. If there was nothing else to the near-death experience, it could be neatly explained by science. We would enter a world of darkness and simply die. And yet, the children we interviewed did not say the experience ended with darkness. At the end of the darkness came a beautiful light, filled with complex emotional overtones. Clearly not caused by a dying brain, because the entire brain would have to be working, particularly the limbic system and temporal lobes. They would have to be working to generate both a vision of light and complex emotional images. So it is obvious this light is not coming from a dying brain. Where this light comes from at the point of death is currently unknown, but I feel comfortable in saying it is not generated by a brain that is dying. The group's research demonstrated that near-death experiences were not caused by drugs, sensory deprivation or psychological stress. They studied patients who were on various medications or psychologically stressed and found these people did not have near-death experiences. I feel we have advanced our understanding to know that at death all human beings will undergo a sensation of leaving their body and traveling towards a beautiful, loving light. This obviously conflicts with a materialistic view. The simplest explanation as to why people would think they are leaving their body and traveling towards a beautiful light would be that they are doing what they say they are. If we want to apply Occam's razor to this situation, that the simplest hypothesis to explain any day to is usually the correct one, then the simplest explanation for our day to is that human beings actually have a soul that leaves the body on the point of death. But I suppose other more contorted explanations could be advanced. One explanation by some eminent scientists is that the near-death experience is a universal remembering of the birth experience. Traveling down the dark tunnel of the birth canal and being confronted with the bright light of the outside world at the moment of delivery. Dr. Morse pointed out several problems with this theory. For instance, some patients born by cesarean section have had near-death experiences but clearly had never traveled down a birth canal. This theory is a misunderstanding of the birth process itself. When an infant is born, it is not traveling down a tunnel face forward with eyes open, but is being squashed and smashed through a birth canal with head flexed and eyes closed. Furthermore, when children have told me about their near-death experiences, they do not describe being in a confined closed tunnel until suddenly confronted with the shock of a bright light. They are in a wide black tunnel and are having a psychic experience. And why would the bright light be loving and wonderful to someone being born? The child has left the womb, usually cries and is immediately given to strangers and washed and scrubbed. If a near-death experience is simply a memory of a birth experience, I do not see that the light at birth would be a wonderful loving experience. An impressive aspect of Dr. Morse's research is that he has not simply recorded what his child patients said, he asked them to draw their experience on paper. He now has a collection of large and colorful pictures of the next world, which are sometimes very poignant because the child artists have since died. Dr. Morse's first picture was by the girl who nearly drowned. It showed a world of darkness and there was Elizabeth, the woman with the golden hair. The girl had drawn a dark tunnel which became brightly lit and led to heaven, covered with flowers. Dr. Morse showed me the work of another young artist, Michelle, who was in a severe diabetic coma with the highest blood sugar level ever recorded at the Children's Hospital, Seattle. She was given only a 10% chance of surviving, but recovered. Michelle drew herself floating above her body on the bed. She drew two female figures at her bedside, whom she said were women doctors she had seen when unconscious. Morse thought it unlikely that she would have been attended by two women physicians, but on checking medical records found the girl and the picture were correct. Another small girl, a Mormon child, drew a picture of a near-death experience that disturbed her for some years, and posed an interesting problem for those who say a near-death experience is only a reflection of the subject's own values and mind. This 5-year-old girl, who nearly died of bacterial meningitis, said she floated out of her body and into heaven. That she met Jesus sitting on a stump, not the classic Jesus from the family Bible, but one she drew in a jolly red hat and a blue smock. She also drew pictures of dead people she met, who said they were waiting to be reborn. Morse said, many people would say such an experience is a result of the child's cultural conditioning. But this child was deeply disturbed by her experience because she had been taught you weren't supposed to see Jesus. She said to me over and over again she didn't know either that a soul went to heaven to be reborn. There is no reincarnation in her religion. Her near-death experience conflicted with her spiritual training, and she was deeply troubled by this experience, having nightmares for years afterwards. A child who had a cardiac arrest during an X-ray session drew a picture of what she saw when unconscious. It was her father picking her up and running with her to an emergency room for treatment. To Dr. Morse this seemed unlikely to be true, not the kind of thing hospital staff let happen during a cardiac arrest. He thought the child being saved by her father was a Freudian embellishment. However, he looked at the medical records and talked with the nurses, and found the child was correct. Father panicked when he saw his lifeless daughter and picked her up and ran to the emergency room, chased by frantic doctors and nurses. One picture Dr. Morse values highly is by Corey, a small boy who died of leukemia. This child had visions of what would happen after he died. He would cross a rainbow bridge and enter a crystal castle which he drew tall and elegant as a Disney castle, surrounded by starbursts of light. He said he would go to live in that castle, made of crystal and bright colors, with an old man called God. The boy was already a frequent visitor to the crystal castle. At the age of 7, after 4 years of painful illness, Corey and his mother decided to refuse further treatment. "Don't worry about it," the boy said. "I've been to the crystal castle and talked about it with God. There was a poignant last birthday party for the dying boy, whose bedroom was decked with balloons and toy clowns." Dr. Morse was unhappy about the decision to discontinue treatment, but everybody had learned to respect Corey's pronouncements from the Crystal Castle. For example, in her school days Corey's mother had had a boyfriend, crippled in a car accident, who had spent several painful years unsuccessfully trying to get back onto his feet. She had never spoken of this man to her son. One day Corey told of a visit to the Crystal Castle and said he had been approached by an old high school friend of his mother. "Don't worry, Mom," the man said, "to tell you he can walk now." "He is in the Crystal Castle," said the child. A telephone call to a friend confirmed that the man had died on the day Corey had his vision. During Corey's years of treatment, 9 of his friends died from cancer. Dr. Morse says the boy said he saw them all in the Crystal Castle. Corey himself died within a few days of the date he said God had told him he would go and live in the Crystal Castle forever. Dr. Morse told me, "There's no question that near-death experiences are going to challenge our religious thinkers, our philosophers and our scientists to come up with new concepts of mind and body. We are not some sort of soulless machine, obviously it's far more complex than that." Chapter 7, A Shoe on a Ledge. Nowadays a miracle or paranormal phenomenon not only runs counter to all our everyday experiences, more importantly it appears to threaten the entire closely woven fabric of modern science. For it presents us with a new class of phenomena which science has not only never led us to expect but appears powerless to assimilate. Dr. John Biloff, a middle-aged woman, apparently dead from a heart attack, found herself floating out of body near the ceiling of the ward and watched doctors and nurses working frantically to save her. She drifted out of a window and around the back of the hospital, where something odd caught her eye, a tennis shoe on a window ledge. Almost as soon as she had revived, she told hospital staff, and the shoe was recovered. The patient was a stranger to the city, seriously ill in bed, wired up to various machines for the whole of her stay in hospital. She could hardly have put the shoe on the ledge herself even if she had wanted to. For our television series, this was a near-death experience that offered some verification for near-death experiences as an extra dimension of personal reality, a form of consciousness existing outside the brain of the dying person. On the face of it, this patient showed that going out of body at the hour of death was not a fantasy but a sighted experience, remote from her physical body. Can there be perception independent of our 5 senses? At death, when our physical body, the seat of human intelligence, is reduced to ashes and a puff of smoke at the crematorium, will we find ourselves still in existence floating about in space or on our way down a dark tunnel towards a sanctuary of light? Many people claim their near-death experiences are corroborated out-of-body experiences. Unconscious, even seemingly dead patients have eavesdropped on relatives making telephone calls in another part of the hospital, sometimes to the embarrassment of the caller. People with no medical background have described in elaborate detail doctors fighting to save their life, even to the precise order in which different scalpels were used. Such claims may not be properly verified until somebody records on camera the statements of a newly resuscitated patient and then corroborates his or her story. Some scientists suggest an answer might be to place a motif or secret message, out of sight, near the ceiling of an emergency treatment room. Anyone claiming to have risen out of body would be invited to repeat the hidden message or describe the motif. The shoe on the ledge was as near as we managed to get to such a test. Another near-death experience we tried to record had offered an unusual verification. An eminent American researcher said an elderly woman, blind since she was a young girl, was able to see again when out of body during a near-death experience. In this sighted state she correctly described the goings-on about her. Unfortunately, she was not interested in taking part in our television program. For some critics, a near-death experience seems such a fantastical event, so different to any observable reality, that it is impossible to take it seriously, no matter what supporting evidence is put forward. An out-of-body patient who remembered a Muslim text pasted to the ceiling of the emergency treatment room might have got the information somehow from the man who pasted it up there. Skeptics about near-death experiences are hard to convince, but perhaps that is understandable. Claims for near-death experiences relate to a dimension the scientist cannot find in his laboratory. But if you compare the near-death experiences of a wide variety of people, a few things become clear. There are so many reported cases and all are unreservedly convinced their outlandish experience was real. Their eyes shine as they recall a life-enhancing event, and many have been motivated towards a more virtuous and truthful life. Are such people likely to be interested in exaggeration or deception? Others found their experience difficult to accept and remained silent, often for years, for fear of being ridiculed. Would they fabricate the source of their own potential embarrassment? Would they ever have spoken out unless they were sure the experience was real? Some insisted on telling their stories in the face of even greater odds. Some patients told their near-death experiences to doctors and relatives, and were immediately assumed to have become mentally unbalanced. The doctor told my parents I was delirious and hallucinating. They thought I'd lost my mind and I was sent to a mental hospital, was a comment by one patient. An alternative to disbelieving every far-fetched near-death experience you hear, is the idea that some dying people, by a process we don't yet understand, possibly akin to telepathy or clairvoyance, may know what is going on around them, which they perceive as an out-of-body experience. That cannot explain everything about near-death experiences, as Dr. Melvin Morse has already pointed out, but slightly prizes open the closed mind to the possibility of dimensions of mind not found in medical textbooks. The Shoe on the Ledge case happened in Seattle, a seaboard city in Washington state, famous as the home of the Boeing aircraft company, and as the coronary care capital of America. They say in the States, if you're going to have a heart attack, have it in Seattle, where the standard of coronary care is so high that a greater percentage of patients recover than in most parts of the world. Consequently, Seattle is rich in near-death experiences. The main cause of Seattle's reputation is an efficient emergency ambulance service, MedicOne, a fleet of critical care units, fitted with the latest life support systems and crewed by skilled paramedics. They treat heart attack patients within seconds of reaching the scene. Most coronary cases used to die before they got to hospital, but not anymore. MedicOne say they can treat a patient, anywhere in the city, within 3 minutes of the distress call, and they took us on a demonstration run, racing through the streets, lights flashing and sirens blaring, to prove the point. The Shoe on the Ledge case began in April 1976, when a MedicOne ambulance rushed a heart attack victim into the Harbor View Medical Center. Maria, a woman of Mexican descent, aged about 50, had collapsed on a visit to the city from the Cascade Mountains, Washington state, where she worked as a crop picker. In the hospital, a young social worker, Kim Clark Sharp, who later became an assistant clinical professor, helped Maria and contacted her relatives who were not on the telephone. 3 days after Maria was admitted, Kim Clark Sharp saw the emergency team rush past her office to the patient's beside. From the doorway, she saw the crash team go into action. Maria's heart had stopped beating. Air was squeezed from a bag and down the patient's throat. Doctors and nurses pounded her chest, while an electrocardiograph machine spilled printouts of Maria's condition onto the floor. Electric shock treatment was tried, live paddles applied to either side of her body, and the flat line of her heart rhythm on the display monitor changed to a blip. There was a flickering of her pulse and Maria was resuscitated. Some hours later, Kim Clark Sharp was paged to return to the coronary care unit. Medical staff asked her to calm the patient who was so agitated that they feared another cardiac arrest. In a flurry of words, Maria told the social worker, "I saw it. I saw it all." The doctors and nurses were running around and shouting. They punched my chest. Paper was running out of the machine and made a big pile on the floor. A man pushed something over my face. Maria said that during the resuscitation, she found herself up 8 ceiling level, looking down on what was happening around her bed. Kim Clark Sharp told us Maria's story. Maria didn't remember seeing me in the doorway, but I was at a distance from her bed. She had everything else completely right. She knew who was in the room, what the equipment was doing. I didn't believe her. This was at a time when the phrase near-death experience had not been coined and literature about the subject was not widely available as it is today. I had never heard of such a thing. I knew hearing was the last sense to go, so perhaps Maria had heard something of what went on. She had been told what would happen in the event of a cardiac arrest, and she knew who would be tending her, because they'd been about all day. There's a psychological term for what people do when they don't know how to get from point A to B, they sort of fill in the blanks. That's what I thought Maria was doing.